finally gaveled the session to a close. A fire was lit, cocktails served. Richter, who drank only room-temperature mineral water, somehow became entangled with Cécile Leclerc, who insisted on addressing him in her impenetrable French-accented German. Richter managed to decipher every fourth or fifth word, which was a blessing. Like her father, Cécile was no intellectual. Somehow she had managed to acquire a law degree from an elite Paris institution of learning. Still, one could easily picture her behind the counter of a Provençal boucherie with a bloody apron around her ample waist. Therefore, Richter was relieved when Jonas Wolf, perhaps sensing his discomfort, cut in like a dancer on a ballroom floor and asked whether they might have a word in private. Followed by Andreas Estermann, they walked through the unpopulated rooms of the chalet to Wolf's chapel. It was the size of a typical Paris church. The walls were hung with German and Dutch old master paintings. Above the altar was a magnificent crucifixion by Lucas Cranach, the elder. Wolf genuflected, and then rose unsteadily to his feet.
All in all, a productive session, don't you think, Excellency?
I must admit I was a bit distracted by Van der Meer's hair. Wolf nodded sympathetically.
I've spoken to him about it.
He insists it's part of his branding. Branding? It's a modern word used to describe one's image on social media. Wolf gestured toward Estermann. Andreas is our expert on that sort of thing. He's convinced Van der Meer's hair is a political asset. It looks like Kim Novak in Vertigo. And the ridiculous comb-over. How on earth does he maneuver it all into place? Apparently, it takes a great deal of time and effort. He buys hairspray by the case. He's the only man in Holland who doesn't go outside when it rains. It conveys a sense of vanity and deep insecurity. Our candidates must be above reproach. They can't all be as polished as Jörg Kaufmann. Brunner has his problems too. Fortunately, the bombings in Berlin and Hamburg have given his campaign a badly needed boost. The new polls are encouraging. But can he win?
If there is another attack, said Wolf, his victory will be all but assured.
He sat down in the first pew. Richter joined him. There followed a companionable silence. Richter might have despaired of the rabble upstairs, but Jonas Wolf he truly admired. Wolf was one of the few men who had been a member of the order longer than Richter. He was its most prominent layman, a co-superior general in everything but name. For more than a decade, he and Richter had been engaged in a clandestine crusade to transform Western Europe and the Church of Rome. Sometimes even they were astounded by the speed with which they had succeeded. Italy and Austria were already theirs. Now the German Federal Chancellery was within their grasp, as was the Apostolic Palace. The seizure of power was nearly complete. Lesser men would serve as their public standard bearers, but it would be Jonas Wolf and Bishop Hans Richter of the Order of St. Helena who would be whispering in their ears. They saw themselves in apocalyptic terms. Western civilization was dying. Only they could save it. Andreas Estermann was the third member of their Holy Trinity. He was the project's irreplaceable man. Estermann dispersed the money, worked with the local parties to hone their platforms and recruit presentable candidates, and oversaw a network of operatives drawn from Western European intelligence services and police forces. In a computer-filled warehouse outside Munich, he had established an information warfare unit that flooded social media daily with false or misleading stories about the threat posed by Muslim immigrants. Estermann's cyber unit also possessed the ability to hack phones and crack computer networks, a capability that had produced mountains of invaluable, compromising material. At present, Estermann was pacing silently along the right side of the nave. Bishop Richter could see that something was troubling him. It was Jonas Wolf who explained. The previous evening, Archbishop Donati and Gabriel Allon had traveled to Canton Fribourg, where they had met with Stephanie Hoffmann.
I thought she told you she didn't know anything.
I had the distinct impression she wasn't telling the truth, answered Estermann.
Was the Janssen boy in possession of the letter when he was killed?
Our friends in the Polizia di Stato say not, which means it's probably in the hands of Archbishop Donati.
Bishop Richter exhaled heavily.
Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest
I would advise against it, said Esterman. Donati's death would undoubtedly delay the start of the conclave.
Then perhaps we should kill his friend instead.
Esterman stopped pacing. Easier said than done.
Where are they now?
Back in Rome.
Doing what?
We're good, Bishop Richter, but not that good. May I offer you a piece of advice?
Of course, Excellency.
Get better, and quickly.
Chapter 22. Rome. The main entrance of the Vatican secret archives was located on the northern side of the Belvedere courtyard. Only accredited historians and researchers were granted access, and only after a thorough vetting, presided over by none other than the Prefetto, Cardinal Domenico Albanese. Visitors were not permitted to venture beyond the Sala di Studio, a reading room furnished with two long rows of ancient wooden desks, recently upgraded with electrical outlets for laptop computers. With rare exceptions, only members of the staff went down to the manuscript depository, which was reached via a cramped lift in the index room. Even Donati had never been there. Try as he might, he could fathom no set of circumstances, no reasonable-sounding cover story that would allow him to wander the depository unaccompanied, let alone with the Director General of Israel's Secret Intelligence Service at his side. It was for that reason Gabriel and Donati went straight to the Israeli embassy after their return to Rome. There, they descended to a secure communications room known as the Holy of Holies, where Gabriel conducted a conference call with Uzi Navot and Yuval Gershon, the director of Unit 8200. Navot was appalled by the operation Gabriel had in mind. Gershon, however, could not believe his good fortune. Having cracked the data network of the Pontifical Swiss Guard, he was now being asked to seize control of the power supply and security system of the Vatican secret archives. For a cyber warrior, it was a dream assignment.
Can it be done? Asked Gabriel.
You're joking, right?
How long will it take?
48 hours, to be on the safe side.
I can give you 24, but 12 would be better.
It was dusk when Gabriel and Donati finally slipped from the Israeli compound in the back of an embassy car. After dropping Donati at the Jesuit Curia, the driver took Gabriel to the safe flat near the top of the Spanish steps. Exhausted, he crawled into the unmade bed and plunged into a dreamless sleep. His phone woke him at 7 the next morning. It was Yuval Gershon.
I'd feel better if we did a few dry runs, but we're ready when you are.
Gabriel showered and dressed, then walked through the cold Roman morning to the Borgo Santo Spirito. Donati met him at the entrance of the Jesuit Curia and escorted him upstairs to his rooms. It was 8:30.
You can't possibly be serious.
Would you prefer to dress as a nun?
Gabriel looked at the clothing laid out on the bed. A clerical suit, a black shirt with a Roman collar. He had utilized many disguises during his long career, but never had he concealed himself beneath the mantle of a priest.
Who am I supposed to be?
Donati handed him a Vatican pass.
Father Franco Benedetti?
It has a certain flair, don't you think?
That's because it's a Jewish name.
So is Donati.
Gabriel frowned at the photograph. I look nothing like him.
Consider yourself lucky, but don't worry. The Swiss guards probably won't even bother to check it.
Gabriel did not disagree. While restoring Caravaggio's Deposition of Christ for the Vatican Museums, he had been issued a pass that granted him access to the conservation labs. The Swiss guard at St. Anne's Gate had rarely given it more than a cursory glance before waving him onto the territory of the city-state. Most members of Rome's large religious community seldom bothered to display their credentials. Annona, the name of the Vatican supermarket, worked like a secret password. Gabriel held the clerical suit against his body.
Stefanie Hoffmann was right, said Donati. You really do look like a priest.
Let's hope no one asks for my blessing.
Donati waved his hand dismissively.
There's nothing to it.
Gabriel went into the bathroom and changed. When he emerged, Donati straightened the Roman collar.
How do you feel?
Gabriel slipped a beretta into the waistband of his trousers at the small of his back.
Much better.
Donati grabbed his briefcase on the way out the door and led Gabriel downstairs to the street. They walked to Bernini's colonnade, then turned to the right. The Piazza Papa Pio XII was jammed with satellite trucks and reporters, including a correspondent from French television who pressed Donati for a comment on the approaching conclave. She relented when the archbishop shot her a curial glare.
"Very impressive," said Gabriel, sotto voce.
"I have something of a reputation." They passed beneath the Passetto, the elevated escape route last utilized by Pope Clement VII in 1527 during the sack of Rome, and walked along the pink facade of the Swiss Guard barracks. A halberdier in a simple blue uniform stood watch at St. Anne's Gate. Donati crossed the invisible border without slowing. Waving Father Benedetti's pass, Gabriel did the same. Together they headed up the Via Sant'Anna toward the Apostolic Palace.
"Do you suppose that nice Swiss boy is watching us?"
"Like a hawk," murmured Donati.
"How long before he tells Metzler you're back in town?"
"If I have to guess, he already has." Cardinal Domenico Albanese, prefect of the Vatican Secret Archives at Camerlengo of the Holy Roman Church, was sampling the global television coverage of the pending conclave when the power suddenly failed in his apartment above the lapidary gallery. It was not an altogether unusual occurrence. The Vatican received most of its electricity from Rome's notoriously fickle grid. Consequently, the denizens of the Curia spent much of their time in the dark, which surely would not have come as a surprise to their critics. Most curial cardinals scarcely noticed the periodic outages. Domenico Albanese, however, was the ruler of a climate-controlled empire of secrets, much of it underground. Electricity was necessary for the smooth administration of his realm. Because it was a Sunday, the archives were officially closed, thus reducing the likelihood of a priceless Vatican treasure walking out the door. Still, Albanese preferred to err on the side of caution. He lifted the receiver of the phone on his desk and dialed the archives control room. There was no answer. In fact, there was no sound at all. Albanese rattled the switch. Only then did he realize there was no dial tone. It appeared the Vatican's phone system was down as well. He was still dressed in his nightclothes. Fortunately, he lived above the store. A private corridor overlooking the Belvedere courtyard delivered him to the upper level of the secret archives. There was not a light burning anywhere. In the control room, a pair of security guards sat staring at a wall of darkened video monitors. The entire network appeared frozen.
"Why haven't you switched over to auxiliary power?" asked Albanese.
"It's not functioning, Eminence."
"Is there anyone inside the archives?"
"The Sala di Studio and the index rooms are empty, so is the manuscript depository."
"Go downstairs and have a look, just to be sure."
"Right away, Eminence."
Satisfied his kingdom was safe from danger, Albanese returned to his apartment and drew his morning bath, unaware of the two men walking along the Via Sant'Anna past the entrance of the Vatican Bank. One of the men had a gun concealed beneath his ill-fitting clerical suit and an unusually large mobile phone pressed to his ear. Highly secure, it was connected to an operations room in North Tel Aviv, where a team of the world's most formidable hackers awaited his next command. Needless to say, Albanese's realm was far from secure. Indeed, at that moment, it was in mortal peril. Before reaching the entrance to the Belvedere courtyard, Gabriel and Donati turned to the right and wound their way through the business quarter of Vatican City to a seldom-used service door at the base of the antiquity-filled Garamonti Museum. It was adjacent to a complex of industrial air conditioners that controlled the climate in the manuscript depository, which lay several meters beneath their feet. Gabriel stared directly into the lens of the security camera.
"Can you see me?"
"Nice outfit," said Yuval Gershon. "Just open the door."
The deadbolt thumped. Donati pulled the latch and led Gabriel into a small foyer. Directly before them was a second door and another security camera. Gabriel gave the signal, and Yuval Gershon opened the door remotely. Beyond it was a stairwell. Four flights down, Gabriel and Donati arrived at another door. It was the first level of the manuscript depository. Four additional flights brought them to the second level and yet another door. A buzzer groaned, a deadbolt snapped. Donati seized the latch, and together they went inside. Chapter 23. Vatican Secret Archives. The darkness was impenetrable. Gabriel switched on his phone's unusually bright flashlight and was somewhat disappointed by what he saw. At first glance, the manuscript depository looked like the underground level of an ordinary university library. There were even trolleys piled with books. He illuminated the spine of one of the volumes. It was a collection of wartime diplomatic documents and cables from the Secretariat of State. "Next time," promised Donati. An empty aisle stretched before them, lined on both sides with gunmetal gray shelves. Gabriel and Donati followed it to an intersection and turned to the right. After about 30 meters, a woven wire mesh storage enclosure blocked their path. Gabriel played the beam of his flashlight around the interior. The books resting on the metal shelves were very old. Some were the size of a typical monograph, others were smaller and covered in cracked leather. None looked as though they had been produced by anything other than a human hand. "I think we've come to the right place." They were now at the westernmost edge of the depository, directly beneath the Cortile della Pigna. Donati led Gabriel past a row of enclosures to an unmarked metal door, pale green, watched over by a security camera. There was no sign or placard to indicate the sort of material stored in the chamber behind it. The professional-grade locks looked newly installed. There was one for the deadbolt and a second for the latch. Both appeared to be 5-pin mechanisms. Gabriel handed his phone to Donati. Then he drew a thin metal tool from the pocket of his borrowed clerical suit and inserted it into the mechanism for the deadbolt. "Is there anything you can't do?" asked Donati. "I can't pick this lock if you don't stop talking." "How long will it take?" "That depends on how many more questions you intend to ask." Donati aimed the beam of the flashlight at the lock. Gabriel worked the tool gently inside the mechanism, testing for resistance, listening for the drop of a pin.
"Don't bother," said a voice calmly. "You won't find what you're looking for."
Gabriel turned. In the darkness, he could see nothing. Donati aimed the phone's flashlight into the void. It illuminated a man in a cassock. No, thought Gabriel, not a cassock, a robe. The man moved forward, soundlessly on sandaled feet. He was identical to Gabriel in height and build, about 5'8", no more than 160 pounds. His hair was black and curly, his skin was dark. He had an ancient face like an icon come to life. He took another step forward. His left hand was heavily bandaged, so was his right. It was clutching a manila envelope.
"Who are you?" asked Donati.
His face registered no change in expression.
"You don't know me? I'm Father Joshua, Excellency."
He spoke fluent Italian, the language of the Vatican, but it was obviously not his native tongue. His name seemed to mean nothing to Donati. He lifted his eyes to the ceiling.
"You mustn't stay long. Cardinal Albanese instructed the security guards to search the depository. They're on their way."
"How do you know?" He lowered his gaze toward the pale green door.
"I'm afraid the book is gone, Excellency."
"Do you know what it was?"
"This will tell you everything you need to know."
The priest handed Donati the envelope. The flap was sealed with clear packing tape.
"Don't open it until you're outside the walls of the Vatican."
"What is it?" asked Donati. The priest lifted his eyes toward the ceiling again.
"It's time for you to leave, Excellency. They're coming."
Only then was Gabriel able to hear the voices. He seized his phone from Donati and extinguished the light. The darkness was absolute.
"Follow me," whispered Father Joshua. "I know the way."
They walked in a single file, the priest leading, Gabriel behind Donati. They made a right turn, then a left, and a moment later they were back at the door through which they had entered the depository. It opened to Father Joshua's touch. He raised a hand in farewell and then melted once more into the gloom. They entered the stairwell and climbed the 8 flights of steps. Gabriel's phone had lost its connection to Unit 8200. When he redialed, Yuval Gershon answered instantly.
"I was getting worried.
Can you see us?"
"I can now."
Gershon unlocked the last 2 doors simultaneously. Outside, the sharp Roman sunlight dazzled their eyes. Donati slipped the envelope into his briefcase and reset the combination locks. "Maybe I should carry that," said Gabriel as they set off toward the Via Santana.
"I outrank you, Father Benedetti."
"That's true, Excellency. But I'm the one with the gun.
It was at that instant the lights flickered to life in Cardinal Domenico Albanese's apartment. Dripping wet, he lifted the receiver of his internal Vatican phone and heard the pleasing pulse of a dial tone. The duty officer in the archive's control room answered on the first ring. Yes, he said. The power had been restored. The computer network was in the process of rebooting, and the security cameras and automatic doors were once again functioning normally.
Is there any evidence of an intrusion?
None, Eminence. Relieved, Albanese placed the receiver gently in its cradle and took a moment to ponder the view from the window of his private study. It lacked the grandeur of the vista from the papal apartments. He could not see St. Peter's Square or even the dome of the Basilica, but it allowed him to monitor the comings and goings at St. Anne's Gate. At present, the Via Sant'Anna was deserted except for a tall archbishop and a smallish priest in a slightly ill-fitting clerical suit. They were headed toward the gate at a parade ground clip. The priest's hands were empty, but in the right hand of the archbishop was a fine leather briefcase. Albanese recognized it. Indeed, he had often expressed admiration for the bag. He recognized the archbishop as well. But who was the priest? Albanese had but one suspect. He reached for his phone and made one final call. A devout Catholic who attended Mass daily, Colonel Alois Metzler, commandant of the Pontifical Swiss Guard, did his best to avoid the office on Sundays. But because it was the Sunday before the start of a conclave, a most sacred undertaking that would be watched by billions around the world, he was at his desk in the Swiss Guard barracks when Colonel Albanese telephoned. The Camerlengo was molto agitato. In frenetic Italian, which Metzler spoke fluently, if reluctantly, he explained that Archbishop Luigi Donati and his friend Gabriel Alon had just broken into the secret archives and were at that moment headed toward St. Anne's Gate. Under no circumstances, shouted the Cardinal, were they to be allowed to leave the territory of Vatican City. If the truth be told, Metzler was in no mood to tangle with the likes of Donati and his friend from Israel, whom Metzler had seen in action on more than one occasion. But because the throne of St. Peter was empty, he had no choice but to obey a direct order from the Camerlengo. Rising, he hurried through the barracks to the lobby, where a duty officer sat behind a half-moon desk, his eyes on a bank of video monitors. In one, Metzler saw Donati marching toward St. Anne's Gate, a priest at his side.
Good God, Metzler murmured. The priest was alone.
Through the open door of the barracks, Metzler saw a young halberdier standing in the Via Sant'Anna, hands clasped behind his back. He shouted at the sentry to block the gate, but it was too late. Donati and Alon strode across the invisible border in a black blur and were gone. Metzler hastened after them. They were now walking swiftly through the crowds of tourists along the Via di Porta Angelica. Metzler called Donati's name. The archbishop stopped and turned.
Alon kept walking.
Donati's smile was disarming.
What is it, Colonel Metzler?
Colonel Albanese believes you just entered the secret archives without authorization.
And how would I have done that? The archives are closed today. The Cardinal believes you had help from your friend.
Father Benedetti?
I saw him in the monitor, Excellency. I know who that was.
You are mistaken, Colonel Metzler. And so is Cardinal Albanese. Now, if you will excuse me, I'm late for an appointment. Donati turned without another word and set off towards St. Peter's Square. Metzler addressed his back.
Your Vatican pass is no longer valid, Excellency. From now on, you stop at the permissions desk like everyone else.
Donati raised a hand in affirmation and kept walking. Metzler returned to his office and immediately rang Albanese. The Camerlengo was molto agitato. Gabriel was waiting for Donati near the end of the colonnade. Together they returned to the Jesuit Curia. Upstairs in his rooms, Donati drew the envelope from his briefcase and pried open the flap. Inside, between two protective sheets of clear film, was a single page of handwritten text. The left edge of the page was clean and straight, but the right was tattered and frayed. The characters were Roman, the language was Latin. Donati's hands shook as he read it. Evangelium secundum Pilati. The Gospel according to Pontius Pilate. Part 2. Ecce Homo. Chapter 24. Jesuit Curia, Rome. Even his first name was lost to the mists of time, the name his mother and father had called him the day he was presented to the gods, and a golden amulet, a bulla, was hung around his tiny neck to ward off evil spirits. Later in life, he would have answered to his cognomen, the third name of a Roman citizen, a hereditary label used to distinguish one branch of a family from the others. His had three syllables, not two, and sounded nothing like the version that would follow him down through the ages and into infamy. The year of his birth is not known, nor the place. One school of thought held that he was from Roman-ruled Spain. Perhaps Tarragona and the Catalonian coast, or Seville, where even today, near the Plaza de Argüelles, there stands an elaborate Andalusian palace known as the Casa de Pilatos. Another theory, prevalent in the Middle Ages, imagined he was the illegitimate child of a German king called Tyrus and a concubine named Pila. As the legend goes, Pila did not know the name of the man who impregnated her, so she combined her father's name with her own and called the boy Pilatus. His most likely place of birth, however, was Rome. His ancestors were probably Samnites, a warlike tribe who inhabited the craggy hills south of the city. His second name, Pontius, suggested he was a descendant of the Pontii, a clan that produced several important Roman military figures. His cognomen, Pilatus, meant skilled with a javelin. It is possible Pontius Pilate, through his military exploits, earned the name himself. The more plausible explanation is that he was the son of a knight and a member of the equestrian order, the second tier of Roman nobility, falling just beneath the senatorial class. If so, he would have enjoyed a comfortable Roman upbringing. The family home would have had an atrium, a colonnaded garden, running water, and a private bath. A second dwelling, a villa, would have overlooked the sea. He would have traveled the streets of Rome not on foot, but held aloft in a litter by slaves. Unlike most children at the dawn of the first millennium, he would have never known hunger. He would have wanted for nothing. His education would have been rigorous, several hours of instruction each day in reading, writing, mathematics, and, when he was older, the finer points of critical thinking and debate, skills that would serve him well later in life. He would have honed his physique with regular weightlifting and then recovered from his efforts with a trip to the baths. For entertainment, he would have reveled in the blood-soaked spectacles of the games. It was unlikely he ever saw the Flavian Amphitheater, the great circular Colosseum built in the low valley between the Coelian, Esquiline, and Palatine hills. The project was funded with spoils from the temple in Jerusalem, which he knew intimately. He would not witness its destruction in 70 CE, though surely he must have known its days were numbered. The new and restive province of Judea was some 1,400 miles from Rome, a journey of 3 weeks or more by sea. Pontius Pilate, after serving several years as a junior officer in the Roman army, arrived there in 26 CE. It was not a coveted post. Syria to the north and Egypt to the southeast were far more important. But what Judea lacked in stature, it more than made up for in potential trouble. Its native population considered themselves chosen by their god and superior to their pagan polytheist occupiers. Jerusalem, their holy city, was the only place in the empire where local inhabitants did not have to prostrate themselves before an image of the emperor. Pilate, if he was to succeed, would have to handle them with care. He had no doubt seen these people in Rome. They were the bearded, circumcised inhabitants of Regio 14, a crowded quarter on the west side of the Tiber that would one day become known as Trastevere. There were perhaps 4.5 million of them spread throughout the empire. They had thrived under Roman rule, taking advantage of the freedom of commerce and movement the empire afforded them. Everywhere they settled, they were wealthy and much admired as a God-fearing people who loved their children, respected human life, and looked after the poor, the sick, the widowed, and the orphaned. Julius Caesar spoke highly of them and granted them important rights of association, which allowed them to worship their god instead of Rome's. But those who lived in the ancestral homeland of Judea, Samaria, and the Galilee were a less cosmopolitan lot. Violently anti-Roman, they were riven with sects, perhaps as many as 24, including the puritanical Essenes, who did not recognize the authority of the temple. A massive complex atop Mount Moriah in Jerusalem
It was controlled by Sadducee aristocrats who profited through their association with the occupation and worked closely with the Roman prefect to assure stability. Pilate was only the fifth to serve in the post. His headquarters were in Caesarea, a Roman enclave of gleaming white marble on the Mediterranean coast. There was a curving promenade by the sea where he could stroll when the weather was fine, and Roman temples where he made sacrifices to his gods, not theirs. Pilate, if he was so inclined, might well have imagined he had never left home. It was not his task to remake the inhabitants of the province, they would one day become known as Jews, in Rome's image. Pilate was a collector of taxes, a facilitator of trade, and a writer of endless reports to Emperor Tiberius, which he sealed with wax and marked with the signet ring he wore on the last finger of his left hand. Rome, by and large, did not involve itself in every facet of culture and society in the lands it occupied. Its laws hibernated during periods of tranquility and awoke only when there was a threat to order. Troublemakers typically received a warning, and if they foolishly persisted, they were dealt with swiftly and brutally. Pilate's immediate predecessor, Valerius Gratus, once dispatched 200 Jews simultaneously with Rome's preferred method of execution, death on the cross. After a revolt in 4 BC, 2,000 were crucified outside Jerusalem. So powerful was their faith in their one God, they went to the cross without fear. As prefect, Pilate was Judea's chief magistrate, its judge and jury. Even so, the Jews handled much of the province's civil administration and law enforcement through the Sanhedrin, the rabbinical tribunal that convened daily, except for religious festivals and the Sabbath, in the hall of hewn stones on the north side of the temple complex. Pilate was under orders from Emperor Tiberius to grant the Jews wide latitude in running their own affairs, especially when it came to matters of their religion. He was to remain in the background whenever possible, the hidden hand, Rome's invisible man. But Pilate, quick-tempered and vindictive, soon developed a reputation for savagery, theft, endless executions, and needless provocations. There was, for example, his decision to affix military standards bearing the emperor's likeness to the walls of the Antonia fortress, which overlooked the temple itself. Predictably, the Jews reacted with fury. Several thousand surrounded Pilate's palace in Caesarea, where a week-long standoff ensued. When the Jews made it clear that they were prepared to die if their demands were not met, Pilate relented and the standards were removed. And then there was Pilate's admittedly impressive aqueduct, which he financed, at least in part, with sacred money, corban, stolen from the temple treasury. Once again he was confronted by a large crowd, this time at the great pavement, the elevated platform outside Herod's citadel, which served as Pilate's Jerusalem headquarters. Sprawled impassively atop his curule chair, Pilate silently endured their abuse for a time, before ordering his soldiers to unsheathe their swords. Some of the unarmed Jews were hacked to pieces, others were trampled in the melee. Lastly, there were the gold-plated shields dedicated to Tiberius that he hung in his Jerusalem apartments. The Jews demanded the shields be removed, and when Pilate refused, they dispatched a letter of protest to none other than the emperor himself. It reached Tiberius while he was on holiday in Capri, or so claimed the philosopher Philo. Seething with rage over his prefect's needless blunder, Tiberius ordered Pilate to remove the shields without delay. He went to Jerusalem as seldom as possible, usually to oversee security during Jewish festivals. Passover, the celebration of the Jews' deliverance from bondage in Egypt, was rife with both religious and political implications. Hundreds of thousands of Jews from across the empire, in some cases entire villages, descended on the city. The streets were jammed with pilgrims and perhaps a 250,000 bleating sheep awaiting ritual slaughter. Lurking in the shadows were the Sicarii, cloaked Jewish zealots who killed Roman soldiers with their distinctive daggers and then disappeared into the crowds. At the center of this pandemonium was the temple. Roman soldiers kept watch on the celebrations from their garrison at the Antonia, Pilate from his splendid private chambers in Herod's citadel. Any hint of unrest, a challenge to Roman rule or to the collaborative temple authorities, would have been dealt with ruthlessly, lest the situation spin out of control. One spark, one agitator, and Jerusalem might erupt. It was into this volatile city, perhaps in the year 33 CE,
or perhaps as early as 27, or as late as 36, that there came a Galilean, a healer, a worker of miracles, a preacher of parables who warned that the kingdom of heaven was at hand. He arrived, as prophesied, astride an ass. It is possible Pilate already knew of this Galilean, and that he witnessed his tumultuous entrance into Jerusalem. There were many such messianic figures in first century Judea, men who called themselves the Anointed One and promised to rebuild David's kingdom. Pilate viewed these preachers as a direct threat to Roman rule and extinguished them without mercy. Invariably, their adherents suffered the same fate. Historians disagree on the nature of the incident that led to the Galilean's earthly demise. Most concur that a crime was committed, perhaps a physical attack on the currency traders in the royal portico, perhaps a verbal tirade against the temple elite. It is possible Roman soldiers witnessed the disturbance and took the Galilean into custody straight away. But tradition holds that he was arrested by a joint Roman-Jewish force on the Mount of Olives after sharing a final Pesach meal with his disciples. What happened next is still less clear. Even the traditional accounts are riddled with contradictions. They suggest that sometime after midnight, the Galilean was brought to the house of the high priest, Joseph ben Caiaphas, where he was subjected to a brutal interrogation by a portion of the Sanhedrin. Contemporary historians, however, have cast doubt on this version of the story. After all, it was both Passover and the eve of the Sabbath, and Jerusalem was bursting at the seams with Jews from around the known world. Caiaphas, having put in a long day at the temple, is unlikely to have welcomed the late-night intrusion. Moreover, the trial as described, it was purportedly conducted outside in the courtyard by the light of a bonfire, was strictly forbidden by the laws of Moses and therefore could not have taken place. One way or another, the Galilean ended up in the hands of Pontius Pilate, the Roman prefect and chief magistrate of the province. Tradition holds that he presided over a public tribunal, but no official record of such a proceeding survives. One central fact, however, is indisputable. The Galilean was put to death by crucifixion, the Roman method of execution reserved solely for insurrectionists, probably just outside the city walls where his punishment would serve as a warning. Pilate might have witnessed the man suffering from his chambers in Herod's citadel, but in all likelihood, given his fearsome reputation, the entire episode was quickly forgotten, swept away by some new problem. Pilate, after all, was a busy man. But then again, the prefect may well have carried a memory of the man long after ordering his execution, especially during the final years of his rule in Judea, as followers of the Galilean who was called Jesus of Nazareth took the first halting steps toward creating a new faith. Traumatized by what they had witnessed, they comforted each other with accounts of the Galilean's ministry, accounts that would eventually be written down in books, evangelizing pamphlets known as Gospels, which circulated among communities of early believers. And it was there that Archbishop Luigi Donati, in his rooms at the Jesuit Curia on the Borgo Santo Spirito in Rome, picked up the thread of the story. Chapter 25. Jesuit Curia, Rome. Mark, not Matthew, was the first. It is written in colloquial Koine Greek sometime between 66 and 75 CE. More than 30 years after the death of Jesus, an eternity in the ancient world. The gospel circulated anonymously for several decades before church fathers ascribed it to a companion of the Apostle Peter, a conclusion rejected by most contemporary biblical scholars who contend the author's identity is not known. His audience was a community of Gentile Christians living in Rome, directly under the thumb of the emperor. It is unlikely he spoke the language of Jesus or his disciples, and he probably possessed only passing familiarity with the geography and customs of the land in which the story was set. By the time he took up his pen, nearly all of the first-hand witnesses had died off or been killed. For his source material, he drew upon an oral tradition and perhaps a few written fragments. In the 15th chapter, a blameless and benevolent Pilate is portrayed as having bowed to the demands of a Jewish crowd to sentence Jesus to death. The earliest versions of Mark concluded abruptly with the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb, an ending many early Christians considered anticlimactic and unsatisfying. Later versions of Mark had two alternative endings, In the so-called longer ending, a resurrected Jesus appears in different forms to his disciples.
Mark's original author did not compose the alternative ending, explained Donati. It was probably written hundreds of years after his death. In fact, the 4th century Codex Vaticanus, the oldest known copy of the New Testament, contains the original empty tomb ending.
The Gospel of Matthew, Donati continued, was composed next, probably between 80 and 90 CE, but perhaps as late as 110, long after the cataclysmic First Roman-Jewish War and the destruction of the Temple. Matthew's audience was a community of Jewish Christians living in Roman-occupied Syria. He drew heavily from Mark, borrowing 600 verses, but scholars believe Matthew expanded on the work of his predecessor with the help of the Q source, a theoretical collection of the sayings of Jesus. His work reflects the sharp divide between Jewish Christians who accepted Jesus as the Messiah and Jews who did not. The depiction of Jesus' appearance before Pilate is similar to Mark's, with one critical addition. Pilate, the ruthless Roman prefect, washes his hands in front of the Jewish crowd gathered on the great pavement and declares himself innocent of Christ's blood. To which the crowd replies, "His blood shall be on us and our children." It is the most consequential line of dialogue ever composed. 2,000 years of persecution and slaughter of Jews at the hands of Christians can be traced back to those 9 terrible words.
Why were they written? Asked Gabriel.
As a Roman Catholic prelate and a man of great personal faith, I believe the Gospels were divinely inspired. That said, they were composed by human beings long after the events took place, and were based on stories of Jesus' life and ministry told by his earliest followers. If there was indeed a tribunal of some sort, Pilate undoubtedly spoke very few, if any, of the words the Gospel writers put in his mouth. The same would be true, of course, of the Jewish crowd, if there was one. "Let his blood be upon us and our children," did they really shout such an awkward and outlandish line? And with a single voice? Where were the followers of Jesus who came to Jerusalem with him from the Galilee? Where were the dissenters?
Donati shook his head.
That passage was a mistake. A sacred mistake, but a mistake nonetheless.
But was it an innocent mistake?
A professor of mine at the Gregoriana used to refer to it as the longest lie. Privately, of course. Had he done so openly, he would have been dragged before the congregation of the doctrine of the faith and defrocked.
Is the scene in Matthew's gospel a lie?
The author of Matthew would tell you that he wrote the story as he had heard it himself, and as he believed it to be. That said, there is no doubt that his gospel, like Mark's, shifted the blame for Jesus' death from the Romans to the Jews.
Why?
Because within a few short years of the crucifixion, the Jesus movement was in grave danger of being reabsorbed by Judaism. If there was a future, it lay with the Gentiles living under Roman rule. The evangelists and the church fathers had to make the new faith acceptable to the empire. There was nothing they could do to change the fact that Jesus died a Roman death at the hands of Roman troops. But if they could suggest that the Jews had forced Pilate's hand,
problem solved.
Donati nodded. And I'm afraid it gets worse in the later Gospels. Luke suggests it was the Jews rather than the Romans who nailed Jesus to the cross. John makes the accusation straight out. It is inconceivable to me that the Jews would crucify one of their own. They might well have stoned Jesus for blasphemy. But the cross? Not a chance.
Then why was the passage included in the Christian canon?
It is important to remember that the Gospels were never intended to be factual records. They were theology, not history. They were evangelizing documents that laid the foundation of a new faith, a faith that by the end of the first century was in sharp conflict with the one from which it had sprung. 3 centuries later, when the bishops of the early church conveyed the Synod of Hippo, there were many different Gospels and other texts circulating among the Christian communities of North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean. The bishops canonized only 4, knowing full well they contained numerous discrepancies and inconsistencies. For example, all the canonical Gospels give a slightly different account of the 3 days leading up to Jesus' execution.
Did the bishops also know they were planting the seeds for 2,000 years of Jewish suffering?
A fair question.
What's the answer?
By the end of the 4th century, the die had been cast. The refusal of the Jews to accept Jesus as their savior was regarded as a mortal threat
to the early church. How could Jesus be the one true path to salvation if the very people who heard his message with their own ears clung to their faith? Early Christian theologians wrestled with the question of whether the Jews should even be allowed to exist. St. John Chrysostom of Antioch preached that synagogues were whorehouses and dens of thieves, that Jews were no better than pigs and goats, that they had grown fat from having too much to eat, that they should be marked for slaughter. Not surprisingly, there were numerous attacks on the Jews of Antioch, and their synagogue was destroyed. In 414, the Jews of Alexandria were wiped out. Regrettably, it was only the beginning. Still dressed in his borrowed clerical suit, Gabriel went to the window and, parting the blinds, peered into the Borgo Santo Spirito. Donati was seated at his writing desk. Before him, still in his sheath of protective plastic, was the page from the book. Evangelium Secundum Pilati. For the record, said Donati after a moment, the Nicene Creed, which was written at the First Council of Nicaea, states unequivocally that Jesus suffered under Pontius Pilate. Furthermore, the Church declared in Nostra Aetate in 1965 that the Jews as a people are not collectively responsible for the death of Jesus. And 23 years after that, Pope Wojtyła issued, we remember, his statement on the Church and the Holocaust. I remember it too. It went to great pains to suggest that 2,000 years of church teaching that Jews were the murderers of God had absolutely nothing to do with the Nazis and the Final Solution. It was a whitewash, Excellency. It is curial word salad. Which is why my master stood at the Bima in the great synagogue of Rome and begged the Jews for forgiveness. Donati paused. You remember that too, don't you? You were there, if I recall. Gabriel took down a copy of the Bible from Donati's bookcase and opened it to the 27th chapter of Matthew. What about this? He pointed out the relevant passage. Am I personally guilty of the murder of God, or are the writers of the four Gospels guilty of the most vicious slander in history? The Church has declared that you are not. And I thank the Church for belatedly making that clear. Gabriel tapped the page with his fingertip. But the book still says I am. Scripture cannot be changed. The Codex Vaticanus would suggest otherwise. Gabriel returned the Bible to its place on the shelf and resumed his study of the street. And the other Gospels, the ones bishops rejected at the Synod of Hippo? They were deemed apocryphal. For the most part, they were literary elaborations on the four canonical Gospels. Ancient fan fiction, if you will. There were books like the Infancy Gospel of Thomas that focused on the early life of Jesus. There were Gnostic Gospels, Jewish Christian Gospels, the Gospel of Mary, even the Gospel of Judas. There was also a significant body of Passion Apocrypha, stories devoted to Jesus' suffering and death. One was called the Gospel of Peter. Peter didn't write it, of course. It was pseudepigrapha, or falsely inscribed. The same was true of the Gospel of Nicodemus. That book is better known as the Acta Pilati. Gabriel turned away from the window. The Acts of Pilate? Donati nodded. Nicodemus was a member of the Sanhedrin who lived on a great estate outside Jerusalem. He was said to have been a secret disciple of Jesus and a confidant of Pilate. He's depicted in Caravaggio's Deposition of Christ, the figure in the sienna-colored garment grasping Jesus' legs. Caravaggio gave him Michelangelo's face, by the way. Really? Asked Gabriel, archly. I never knew. Donati ignored the remark. Dating the Acts of Pilate is difficult, but most scholars agree it was probably written in the late 4th century. It purports to contain material composed by Pilate himself while he was in Jerusalem. It was quite popular here in Italy in the 15th and 16th centuries. In fact, it was printed 28 times during that period. Donati held up his phone. To read it now, all you need is one of these. Were there other Pilate books? Several. Such as?
The Memoirs of Pilate, The Martyrdom of Pilate, and The Report of Pilate, to name a few.
The handing over of Pilate describes his appearance before Emperor Tiberius after he was recalled to Rome. Never mind that Tiberius was dead by the time Pilate arrived. There was also the letter of Pilate to Claudius, the letter of Pilate to Herod, the letter of Herod to Pilate, the letter of Tiberius to Pilate.
Donati's voice trailed off. You get the point. What about the Gospel of Pilate? I am unfamiliar with an apocryphal piece of Christian writing by that name. Are any of the other books considered credible?
No, said Donati. They're all forgeries, and they all attempt to exonerate Pilate for Jesus' death while at the same time implicating the Jews.
Just like the canonical Gospels. The bells of St. Peter's Basilica tolled midday. What do you suppose is going on behind the walls of the Vatican?
If I were to guess, Cardinal Albanese is desperately searching for Father Joshua. I fear what will happen if he finds him. As Camerlengo, Albanese has enormous authority. Practically speaking, the Order of St. Helena is running the Roman Catholic Church. The question is, do they intend to relinquish their power, or do they have a plan to keep it?
We still can't prove that the Order killed Lucchese.
Not yet, but we have 5 days to find the evidence.
Donati paused. And the Gospel of Pilate, of course. Where do we start?
Father Robert Jordan.
Who is he?
My professor from the Gregoriana.
Is he still in Rome?
Donati shook his head. He entered a monastery a few years ago. He doesn't use a phone or email. We'll have to drive up there, but there's no guarantee he'll see us. He's quite brilliant. And difficult, I'm afraid.
Where's the monastery?
A small town of considerable religious importance on the slopes of Monte Subasio in Umbria. I'm sure you've heard of it. In fact, I believe you and Chiara used to live not far from there.
Gabriel permitted himself a brief smile. It had been a long time since he had been to Assisi.
Chapter 26. Rome, Assisi. Transport required a minimum of 4 hours to acquire an untraceable car. So Gabriel, after changing into his own clothing, walked to a Hertz outlet near the Vatican walls and rented an Opel Corsa hatchback. He was followed there inexpertly by a man on a motorcycle. Black trousers, black shoes, a black nylon coat, a black helmet with a tinted visor. The same motorcyclist followed Gabriel back to the Jesuit Curia, where he collected Donati.
That's him, said Donati, peering into the side view mirror. That's definitely Father Graf.
I think I'll pull over and have a quiet word with him.
Perhaps you should just lose him instead.
He put up a good fight, especially in the traffic-clogged streets of central Rome. But by the time they reached the autostrada, Gabriel was confident they were not being followed. The afternoon had turned cloudy and cold, so had Gabriel's mood. He leaned his head against the window, a hand balanced atop the wheel.
Was it something I said? Asked Donati at last.
What's that?
You haven't uttered a word in 10 minutes.
I was enjoying the remarkable beauty of the Italian countryside.
Try again, said Donati.
I was thinking about my mother, and about the number tattooed on her arm, and about the candles that burned day and night in the little house where I grew up in Israel. They were for my grandparents, who were gassed upon arrival at Auschwitz and fed into the fires of the crematoria. They had no other grave but those candles. They were ashes on the wind. Gabriel was silent for a moment. That's what I was thinking about, Luigi. I was thinking about how differently the history of the Jews might have unfolded if the Church hadn't declared war on us in the Gospels.
Your characterization is unfair.
Do you know how many Jews there should be in the world?
200 million.
We could be more numerous than the populations of Germany and France combined. But we were wiped out time and time again, culminating with the pogrom to end all pogroms. Quietly, Gabriel added, all because of those 9 words.
It must be said that throughout the Middle Ages, the Church intervened on countless occasions to protect the Jews of Europe.
Why did they need protecting in the first place?
Gabriel answered his own question.
They needed protection because of what the Church was teaching.
And it also must be said, Excellency, that long after Jews were emancipated in Western Europe, they remained ghettoized in the city controlled by the papacy.
Where did the Nazis get the idea of making the Jews wear the Star of David?
They had to look no further than Rome.
One has to distinguish between religious anti-Judaism and racial anti-Semitism.
That is a distinction without a difference.
Jews were resented because they were shopkeepers
and moneylenders. And do you know why they were shopkeepers and moneylenders? Because for more than a millennium, they were forbidden to do anything else. And yet even now, after the horrors of the Holocaust, after all the films and books and memorials and attempts to change hearts and minds, the longest hatred endures. Germany admits it cannot protect its Jewish citizens from harm. French Jews are moving to Israel in record numbers to escape anti-Semitism. In America, neo-Nazis march openly while Jews are being shot and killed in their synagogues. What is the source of this irrational hatred? Could it be that for nearly 2,000 years, the Church taught that the Jews were collectively guilty of deicide? That we were the very murderers of God? Yes, admitted Donati. But what shall we do about it? Find the Gospel of Pilate. South of Orvieto, they turned off the autostrada and headed into the rolling hills and thick forests of Donati's native Umbria. By the time they reached Perugia, the sun had burned a hole in the clouds. To the east, at the base of Monte Subasio, glowed the distinctive red marble of Assisi. There's the Abbey of St. Peter. Donati pointed out the bell tower at the northern end of the city. It's inhabited by a small group of monks from the Cassianese congregation. They live according to the rule of St. Benedict. Ora et labora, pray and work. Sounds a bit like the job description of the chief of the office. Donati laughed. The monks support a number of local organizations, including a hospital and an orphanage. They agreed to give Father Jordan lodging in the abbey when he retired from the Gregoriana. Why Assisi? After working for 40 years as a Jesuit academic and writer, he longed for a more contemplative existence. But you can be sure he finds time to research and write. He's one of the world's foremost authorities on the apocryphal gospels. What happens if he won't see us? I'm sure you'll think of something, remarked Donati. Gabriel left the Opel in a car park outside the city walls and followed Donati through the archway of the Porta San Pietro. The abbey was a few paces along a shadowed street, behind walls of red stone. The outer door was locked. Donati rang the bell. There was no answer. He checked the time. Mid-afternoon prayers. Let's take a walk. They set out along the street against a flow of outward-bound package tourists. Gabriel in dark trousers and a leather coat, Donati in his magenta-trimmed cassock. He attracted no more than passing interest. The Abbey of St. Peter was not the only monastery or convent in Assisi. It was a city of religious. It became Christian, explained Donati, just 200 years after the crucifixion. St. Francis was born in Assisi at the end of the 12th century. Known for his lavish clothing and circle of rich friends, he encountered a beggar one afternoon in the marketplace and was so moved, he gave the man everything he had in his pockets. Within a few years, he was living as a beggar himself. He cared for lepers in a Lazar house, worked as a lowly kitchen servant in a monastery, and in 1209 founded a religious order that required its members to embrace a life of total and complete poverty. Francis is one of the Church's most beloved saints, but he didn't invent the notion of caring for the poor. It was ingrained in Christianity from the beginning. And now, 2 millennia later, thousands of Roman Catholics around the world are doing the same thing every hour of every day. I think that's worth preserving, don't you? I once told Lucchese that I would never want to live in a world without the Roman Catholic Church. Did you? He never mentioned it. They arrived at the Basilica. Shall we go inside and see the paintings? Next time, quipped Gabriel. It was 3:15. They retraced their steps to the abbey, and once again Donati rang the bell. A moment passed before a male voice answered. He spoke Italian with a distinct British accent. Good afternoon, may I help you? I'm here to see Father Jordan. I'm afraid he doesn't accept visitors. I believe he'll make an exception in my case. Your name? Archbishop Luigi Donati. He released the call button and gave Gabriel a sidelong glance. Membership has its privileges. The lock snapped open. A hairless, black-habited Benedictine waited in the shadows of an internal courtyard. Forgive me, Excellency. I wish someone had told us you were coming. He extended a soft, pale hand. I'm Simon, by the way. Follow me, please. They entered the Church of San Pietro through a side door, crossed the nave and emerged into another internal court. The next door gave onto the abbey itself. The monk conveyed them to a modestly furnished common room, overlooking a green garden. Actually, thought Gabriel, it was more like a small farm. Surrounded by a high wall, it was invisible to the outside world. The Benedictine asked them to make themselves comfortable and then withdrew. 10 minutes elapsed before he finally returned. He was alone. "I'm sorry, Excellency, but Father Jordan is praying now and wishes not to be disturbed." Donati opened his briefcase and removed the manila envelope. "Show him this." "But now, Don Simon." Gabriel smiled as the monk fled the room. "It seems your reputation precedes you." "I doubt Father Jordan will be so easily impressed." Another 15 minutes passed before the British monk returned. This time he was accompanied by a small, dark man with a weathered face and a shock of unkempt white hair. Father Robert Jordan was wearing an ordinary cassock rather than the black habit of the Benedictines. In his right hand was the envelope.
"I came here to get away from Rome. Now it seems Rome has come to me."
Father Jordan's gaze settled on Gabriel.
"Mr. Alone, I presume."
Gabriel said nothing. Father Jordan removed the page from the envelope and held it up to the afternoon light streaming through the window.
"It's paper, not vellum. It looks to be from the 15th or 16th century."
"I'll have to take your word for it," replied Donati. Father Jordan lowered the page.
"I've been searching for this for more than 30 years. Where on earth did you find it?"
"It was given to me by a priest who works in the secret archives."
"Does the priest have a name?"
"Father Joshua."
"Are you sure?"
"Why?"
"Because I'm quite certain I know everyone who works in the archives, and I've never heard of anyone by that name."
Father Jordan looked down at the page again.
"Where's the rest of it?"
"It was removed from the papal study the night of the Holy Father's death."
"By whom?"
"Cardinal Albanese." Father Jordan looked up sharply. "Before or after His Holiness died?" Donati hesitated, then said, "It was after."
"Dear God," whispered Father Jordan. "I was afraid you were going to say that."
Chapter 27. Abbey of St. Peter, Assisi. The monk returned with an earthenware carafe of water, a loaf of coarse bread from the monastery's bakery, and a bowl of olive oil produced by an abbey-supported cooperative. Father Jordan explained that he had worked there the previous summer, repairing the damage done to his body by a lifetime of teaching and study. It was obvious he had spent a great deal of time in the out-of-doors of late. His sun-baked face was the color of terracotta. His Italian was animated, flawless. Indeed, were it not for his name and his American-accented English, Gabriel would have assumed that Robert Jordan had lived his entire life in the hills and valleys of Umbria. In truth, he had been raised in the comfortable Boston suburb of Brookline. A brilliant Jesuit academic, he served on the faculties at Fordham and Georgetown before coming to the Pontifical Gregorian University, where he taught history and theology. His private research, however, focused on the apocryphal Gospels. Of particular interest to Father Jordan were the Passion Apocrypha, especially the Gospels and letters focusing on Pontius Pilate. They were, he said, depressing reading, for they seemed to have but one purpose: to acquit Pilate of the death of Jesus and place the blame squarely on the heads of the Jews and their descendants. Father Jordan believed that, intentionally or not, the Gospel writers had erred in their depiction of the trial and execution of Jesus, an error compounded by the inflammatory teachings of church fathers from Origen to Augustine. In the mid-1980s, he learned he was not alone. Without the knowledge of the Jesuit superior general or his chancellor at the Gregoriana, he joined the Jesus Task Force, a group of Christian scholars who attempted to create an accurate portrait of the historical Jesus. The group published its findings in a controversial book. It argued that Jesus was an itinerant sage and faith healer who neither walked on water nor miraculously fed the multitudes with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. He was put to death by the Romans as a public nuisance, not for challenging the authority of the temple elite, and did not rise bodily from the dead. The concept of the resurrection, the task force concluded, was based on visions and dreams experienced by Jesus' closest followers, a view first put forward in 1835 by the theologian David Friedrich Strauss, a German Protestant.
When the book was published, my name didn't appear in the text. Even so, I was terrified my participation would become public. Late at night, I waited for the dreaded knock at the door from the Holy Office of the Inquisition. Donati reminded Father Jordan that the Holy Office was now known as the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. I rose by any other name, Father Donati. I'm an archbishop, Robert. Father Jordan smiled. His participation in the task force, he continued, did not shake his belief in the divinity of Jesus or the core tenets of Christianity. If anything, it strengthened his faith. He had never believed that everything in the New Testament, or in the Torah for that matter, happened as described, and yet he believed with all his heart in the Bible's core truths. It is why he had come to Assisi to be closer to God, to live his life the way Jesus had led his, unburdened by property or possessions. He remained deeply troubled, however, by the Gospel's accounts of the crucifixion, for they had led to countless deaths and untold suffering on the part of the Jewish people. Father Jordan had made it his life's work to find out what really happened that day in Jerusalem. He was convinced that somewhere there was a first-hand account, not an apocryphal document, but a genuine eyewitness.